Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the National Gallery, the Lowy Institute's home in Canberra. In a moment, I'll give you a formal introduction to our guest, Robert Kelly, but for the moment, would you please join me in giving him a warm welcome?
Thank you. Thank you.
So we're here, of course, this evening to discuss the situation on the Korean Peninsula, and we're gathered tonight at a time when the atmosphere on the Korean Peninsula could hardly be more febrile. And I choose that word deliberately because febrile suggests nervous excitement or energy, but it can also imply feverishness or an atmosphere of impending crisis. And when President Trump was elected, the range of possibilities for US policy in countless different areas suddenly opened up because Trump himself is so unpredictable, his views on various issues unformed or just unknown. And America's Korea policy illustrates the point. In the space of a few months, we've seen President Trump lobbing childish insults at North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-un, boasting about the size of his nuclear button, threatening fire and fury on South Korea, and intimating, of course, that the US could use force against North Korea's nuclear arsenal. But, of course, Trump has also agreed to meet personally with Kim Jong-un. And last week we saw some pretty incredible pictures of from the demilitarized zone of the North Korean and South Korean leaders shaking hands across the border. So it's fair to say, I think, that the chances of conflict on the Korean Peninsula have risen this year, but also that we're closer than we've been for perhaps decades to a genuine resolution of the Korea conflict and to a historic shift in Asia's security architecture. So, as I said, febrile. Now, tonight, I'm honoured to host my friend, Robert Kelly, to discuss the situation on the Korean Peninsula. Bob and I have known each other since 2014, when I was editor of the Lowy Institute's digital magazine, The Interpreter, and I was on the lookout for fresh, new voices on Asian security issues. And I've got to say, Bob, it was one of my best decisions to convince you to write for The Interpreter, and Bob remains one of our most read regular columnists. Robert Kelly is an American who's lived in South Korea since 2008. He's a professor of international relations in the political science and diplomacy department of Pusan National University in Busan, where he teaches US foreign policy, security, international relations theory, and US politics. Bob's a regular contributor to The Interpreter, as I said, and to other journals such as The National Interest, Newsweek, Foreign Affairs. He's also in high demand from the broadcast media, apparently that includes the BBC. Bob's in Australia as a guest of the Sydney Writers' Festival, I need to mention that, and he's kindly made this visit to Canberra on behalf of the Lowy Institute. So Bob, thank you so much for being here. I'm going to open up with a few questions of my own and then hand you over to the tender mercies of our audience. I want to say to the audience that my experience hosting events like this is that when I ask for audience questions, a lot of male hands go up. I want to encourage the women in the audience to also ask questions, so I'll be looking out for your raised hands. So Bob, let's begin, and let's begin with the dramatic events of last week across the North Korea-South Korea border. The pictures were incredible, as I said, but what was actually achieved?
Right. Thank you for having me, Sam. It's good to be here. I'd like to thank the Lowy Institute. They've been very good to me over the many years of our relationship, so thank you all for having me. I should also say in passing, in the last year, every talk I do, people ask me, are you the guy from the TV with the kids? Yes, I am. I am BBC dad. So if you're curious about the video, I'm happy to answer your questions on this. You'd be surprised how many people ask me. So if you're curious, happy to answer those questions. My daughter's dance is apparently sort of like a global thing now. Right. I think broadly speaking, the pundit consensus, if you will, last weekend was roughly correct, right? Which was that what we saw this time was something of a rehash of what we saw in 2007. The declarations were practically the same. And in fact, that was one of my big disappointments, which was that this was long on principle, short on detail, just as the statements in 2001 and 2000 and 2007 were. I'm a little surprised, quite honestly, that the South Korean president, who's been very much a supporter of engagement, what the South Koreans call the Sunshine Policy, Moon Jae-in has been a supporter of that. He's been engaged in that for going on 25 years now. And I have to say, I was a little surprised that he was not able to actually get the North Koreans to pin them down to more specific detail. you know, in the months, in the weeks leading up to this, everybody was kind of saying, you know, we're not expecting a whole lot. It's going to be a lot of principle, not a lot of detail. I mean, everybody saw this coming, and it still happened, which just kind of kicks the can down the road even further, right? I mean, at some point, we have to get into real discussions about denuclearization with North Korea. What are they going to give up? What are they not going to give up? What kind of concessions are they going to put on the table? Not just about nuclear weapons, about human rights, small-scale capitalism in North Korea. There are all kinds of things we can discuss. And to my surprise, the Moon Jae-in administration kind of ducked that bullet last week, which just kind of kicks it to Donald Trump, who, as we all know, is a real wild card. And I'm actually rather surprised that the Moon administration didn't take more time to sort of constrain how much room Trump has to move. Right? And this is one of the things I've argued in my writing, is that this was an opportunity for the Koreans to put the summit last week was an opportunity for the South Koreans to sort of put some guardrails up around President Trump so he didn't wander off the rails too far and make some kind of wild suggestion, right? I mean, we've all seen Trump on television, right? He's really prone to be erratic. I'm genuinely concerned about what he's going to say when he gets up there if he does meet Kim. So it was, I mean, it was good, I guess, in the sense of sort of good principles, right? You know, peace and reconciliation, unification, all these things are good, but we've been here before, as everyone said, and it's kind of surprising that the ball wasn't moved further. So we still have to, yeah, get back into the details. At some point, we have to get to the details of what the bargain is going to be, and that was sidestepped, unfortunately, to my mind.
So the fact that it happened at all, is that significant beyond the nice visuals?
Well, gauged against where we were, you know, 4 months ago, 5 months ago, right, when people were talking about nuclear war and totally destroying North Korea and stuff like that, I mean, I think one of the reasons it happened so fast, I mean, this is a big sort of debate, I think, in the analyst community, right? Why is the Moon administration going so rapidly? And I think one of the reasons why is to sort of get last year's war scare as far behind them as possible, right? So get to diplomacy as quickly as possible to prevent Donald Trump from wandering back to fire and fury and stuff like that, especially now that John Bolton is national security advisor. And so one of the reasons why this is going so fast, and I think maybe one of the reasons why the South Koreans weren't able to get concessions from the North Koreans, is because they just didn't have the time, and they didn't want to take the time because they wanted to rush this whole process to constrain Donald Trump from swinging back to what he was saying 6 months ago. If that is correct, that is actually, I think, a wise move, what they call the bloody nose, right, where the Americans would strike North Korea hard enough to convince them to stop testing, but not hard enough to provoke a conflict. A bloody nose, bloody nose strike would be extraordinarily risky, and I think it was wise of the Moon administration to do the best it could to forestall that. But again, it's still, the major issues are still basically out there floating. So, I mean, it's an improvement over where we were 4 months ago. So, and it was great television, I guess, right?
Right. So the fact that this has happened so quickly, you don't put much store in the theory that this is a result of Trump's pressure campaign against North Korea?
No, I do not. I think there are sort of two schools to sort of explain this that are both incorrect because they privilege outsiders sort of pushing North Korea into certain policy positions. So conservatives or hawks want to see that pressure, sanctions, and so on has pushed North Korea to the table. I actually, broadly speaking, support the sanctions regime, but Donald Trump hasn't actually added that much. He's added a little bit. What the president mostly added was the rhetoric, right? Last year, it was the heat that the president actually added last year. For the sanctions to bite, the real story is Chinese enforcement. Do the Chinese actually enforce the sanctions? If they don't, more and more sanctions don't make much difference. So that's the actual empirical story. What the president added was the rhetoric. And then sort of on the left, liberals or doves, their argument is that it was the switch administrations, that the Moon administration believed in outreach, and that once North Korea had a partner for peace in Seoul, the North Koreans would step up and actually, you know, come to the table. I think the problem with both of those positions, first, is there's not a lot of empirical evidence for either one of them, and so they're very attractive for ideological partisans, right? So if you're the Trump administration and you're worried about scandals and Stormy Daniels and whatever, right, this is something that you can claim as a win. So there's a political logic, but there's not actually a lot of data to support that position. I would argue the same for the position on the left, which is that, you know, Moon is, you know, a major improvement over Park Geun-hye, the impeached president was a conservative. And that, you know, he has managed to draw North Korea out of its shell because he's a liberal and he's a dove and he supports engagement. Those are both politically comfortable for partisans on either side, but I don't actually think that they get to the fact that North Korea doesn't really listen to what we on the outside think. You know, if there's any state in the world that kind of freelances and basically does whatever it wants, regardless of what global opinion is, it's North Korea, right? I think it's kind of the arrogance of outsiders to think that we are actually pushing North Korea into making these choices. My own read of this So if you look at, so like what's changed in North Korea's internal politics, right? Well, there hasn't been like a glasnost or anything like that in North Korea, right? There hasn't been liberalization in the last 6 or 8 months or something like that. You know, we know that Kim Jong-un isn't Gorbachev. What has changed, I would argue, is that the North Koreans have achieved the ability to strike the continental United States with a nuclear weapon. And that gives them the confidence now to come forward and deal. They didn't have it before. They were worried about American-led regime change, something like Iraq, happening to them. That's why they built the weapons. Now they have those weapons, and behind that nuclear shield, if you will, they can come forward and say to the world, we're open for business. Come talk to us. What will you give us for the program? And that's why they're not just talking to Donald Trump. They're talking to the Chinese, South Koreans, probably the Japanese, possibly the Russians. They just went and talked to the IOC. I mean, they're basically what they're doing is they're going shopping. Right? They have the weapons, and now they're shopping around for a deal. What will you give me for these weapons, which are very destabilizing and which make everybody really afraid of me? What kind of deal will you give me? And that's what they're looking for, some kind of bargain. So I don't actually think it has much to do with Trump or Moon. I think it's internally driven.
Okay, so with all that said, and with the North Korea-South Korea summit now just behind us, what could happen at the when Trump goes?
Yeah.
Well, we don't know where he's right. going to go yet, but let's assume that the summit is in the demilitarized zone.
Right.
What could possibly happen?
Yeah, I mean, normally that would be an easy question to answer because you'd have sort of like a preset framework because there'd be a lot of staff work and diplomacy that precedes the summit. In this case, there isn't that. Donald Trump made the decision to do this meeting 45 minutes after it was suggested to him, and he wants to have it 9 weeks after that. So the strategic and ideological divisions between the Americans and the North Koreans are pretty wide. You're not going to shrink those divisions in 9 weeks. That gives Donald Trump a lot of room to freelance, which, in my opinion, is kind of nerve-wracking. The president's a real wild card. I am genuinely concerned the president might go up there and say something really zany.
So you've argued actually that the conference that this summit should be canceled.
I have, in fact. I'm actually so afraid that Donald Trump is going to offer something or say something really outrageous or outlandish that I believe actually it's too risky to do it. The outcomes to the summit, if assuming it happens, here's the sort of the range of possibilities as I see it. The most likely possibility, the modal outcome, is that the summit is simply a bust. I would say there's a 70% likelihood that the summit is simply a bust. It's a couple of nice photo ops. It changes the subject for a while. Donald Trump likes it because we're not talking about his scandals. Kim Jong-un likes it because he's meeting the American president as an equal, right? You have a tin pot dictator meeting the head of the free world, one-to-one. That video is going to play on permanent loop in North Korea for the next 25 years, by the way. Right? No, it is, because it's legit. This is one of the big mistakes the president made, right? I mean, the president doesn't, Donald Trump didn't realize, because he doesn't really know a lot about North Korea, that in giving the summit away, he was actually giving a huge concession to the North Koreans already, right? Because the North Koreans have wanted for a long, long time to meet the American president directly one-to-one, because then it legitimates North Korea as a real Korean state, as opposed to a weird, aberrant, backward, neo-feudal mess, which, of course, is what it really is, right? The real Korea is South Korea, right? North Korea is a backward gangster Orwellian tyranny, right? But they don't want to admit that, obviously, right? So when you meet the American president, then you're not an Orwellian gangster anymore. Now you're like a real statesman. And part of the problem with the president is that he didn't actually see that that was actually a really big concession. So we didn't get anything for that. And like I said, that's going to be on loop for the next 20 years in North Korea, right? So now I'm concerned, what is the president going to go in there and offer next? Is he actually able to do this? He doesn't really know a great deal about North Korea, right? I mean, if you listen to some of his speeches in the last couple of months, he seems to have a couple of times mixed up the two Koreas. He said at one point that the United States should have something like the demilitarized zone along the U.S. border with Mexico, which is, I mean, wow. I'm not, you know, for people who do what I do, I'm not really quite sure what I'm supposed to say to that. It's pretty terrifying. And the president has just sort of continued to roll along with this, right? I mean, you guys have seen the YouTube videos. He loses his temper quickly. He called it that Fox TV show a week ago when he was screaming into the phone so much the Fox host tried to get him off the phone because it was like embarrassing. I mean, what if he does that when he meets Kim Jong-un, right? Remember last year was, you know, Fire and Fury and Dotard and Orange Man and Rocket Man and all Fat Man and all that. I mean, what if Kim and Trump slide back into that and they're shouting at each other back and forth across the table? I mean, so it's probably going to be a bust. I think it's 70% likelihood it's going to be a bust and it's going to be those photo ops, which the Kims want. But I think there's also a 20% chance that it really fails badly. Remember, the president has said he might just walk out. Wow. walking out, can you imagine, how would the Kims respond to that? Especially if you, like, so there's also kind of a cultural factor. Like in Confucian East Asia, if you do that, that's like a really big snub, right? What if the president, you know, we know the president is prone to profanity and insult. What if the president swears at him? I mean, how are they, you know, this could very easily go south very badly, and then the Kims walk out, Trump walks out, and we're back to where we were 6 months ago, right? I would say there's a 20% chance of that happening, where this thing really, really goes badly, and things are actually worse. And then there's only about a 10% likelihood that the president can actually make this worthwhile, which is to say that he can actually extract a really good denuclearization deal from North Korea. And so that's my anxiety. Trump is such a wild card. He's such a wild card, right? He's so open to flattery, right? He's so open to insult. He's so moody. I mean, his psychology has just become a major issue in these negotiations now that I think it's just too risky.
Okay, so let's imagine a future in which the Trump administration listens to Robert Kelly's In Conversation event at the Lowy Institute and decides to cancel this thing.
Right.
And then they ring you up and say, okay, smart guy, what do we do now? What is the next step in your world of diplomacy with North Korea?
All right. So if BBC Dad were president for a day, I'd put my daughter in charge. I have no problem. I have no problem with diplomacy with North Korea. I think of myself as a hawk, but not an ultra. You know, people like John Bolton, I don't think they want to talk to North Korea. They just want the nukes or hit them. I do believe we should talk to North Korea. I would like to see the process go through a normal summit chain, though, where you start with the diplomats and the lawyers and the engineers and the military people who actually know these issues in great detail. I mean, nuclear weapons are really complicated. Missile technology is really complicated. If you look at the six-party talks, the last time we had a long negotiation process with the North Koreans, it took several years. I mean, these are difficult, complicated issues. They've been around. You know, we've been talking about nuclear weapons with the North Koreans since the early 1990s. And so my preference would be to have that, have the experts sort of working this out at a lower level, at a working level, staff work, building slowly, right, shrinking that gap slowly, building your way up towards a summit. My big concern is not the summit itself, although with Donald Trump, I suppose, but it's that you're sort of starting at the top of the chain rather than at the bottom. What you should do is build up to that, and then when the differences are narrowed enough, then you bring in the principles for the handshakes and the rest of it and the photos, photo ops, and you bridge those last couple of differences. So I'm not opposed to the summit itself. I'm not opposed to negotiating with the North Koreans. I just think we need to do it in a more professional and responsible way. There needs to be a U.S. ambassador in South Korea, for example. I mean, that strikes me as so obvious. I'm shocked that we're taking the Trump people seriously when they can't even get an ambassador in there. Apparently, yes, we did. Thank you. Right. So another snub. Trumpian diplomacy at work. There's no DPRK. North Korea is also called the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. There's no DPRK point person in the State Department or in the White House. There's no Undersecretary of State for East Asia in the State Department. You've got a new Secretary of State, a new National Security Advisor. The National Security Advisor has a long history of advocating basically not talking to North Korea at all and just starting a war with them. A lot more work needs to go into building a diplomatic framework with North Korea so that we can work our way towards an outcome that will be acceptable to all parties. It would be astonishing if Donald Trump could simply walk into a meeting 6 or 8 weeks after it was first announced, when he knows almost nothing about these issues, and clinch a deal. That is so unlike any of our experience in diplomacy. Again, that's why I'm just so uncomfortable with this. The president's going to wing it. He is. He's not going to do the reading. He's going to walk in there, and he's going to wing it. And we know the president is very susceptible to flattery. What if Kim Jong-un starts flattering him? You know, what if Donald Trump starts talking about how cool it would be to have a golf course in North Korea? It's just so unpredictable, right? But I think the South Koreans are pushing this because they're so afraid that Donald Trump might go back to where he was 6 months ago when it was like, you know, talking about war, that it's better to have him in the room talking to Kim Jong-un, because at least then they're talking as opposed to before. But even the negotiations have big risks to my mind too.
I heard you refer to, you used several colorful terms to describe the North Korean regime just now. Ones I took down include Orwellian, gangster, and tyranny. That leads to that leads to a question. I know you've written a lot about this topic, about the nature of the North Korean regime. So this is kind of an anthropological question. What kind of a government is North Korea? I mean, it's at least nominally, it is still a communist dictatorship. More recently, we've heard it described as a state that's actually founded on a very deeply racist nationalism. What's your view? How do you describe what North Korea actually is as a state?
Sure. I think I've said this for you, too. My bumper sticker for North Korea is that it's an Orwellian gangster fiefdom. Okay, so Orwellian, right? It's basically set up as a Stalinist surveillance society. It's straight out of 1984. It really is. I mean, I've been to North Korea. It really is Big Brother. The pictures everywhere, the paintings everywhere, the statues everywhere. Ideological training, minders. I mean, it really is 1984 in that sense. But it's also, right? That's the internal security framework, right? But the actual political ideology isn't really Marxist-Leninist at all. I think there's general agreement at this point that iconographically North Korea is still Marxist-Leninist, but not in any meaningful way, right? The Marx and Lenin pictures have been taken down from the buildings on Kim Il-sung Square. They're not referenced. Communism is not really referenced anymore in the Constitution. The North Koreans still use the language of socialism somewhat. It does show up in the proclamations from the North Korean news service called KCNA, the Korean Central News Agency. KCNA does occasionally say socialism, but only in a kind of very generic sort of way. North Korea is not really in practice socialist anymore with collectivized agriculture it tolerates a lot of private property at low levels. It tolerates a lot of small-scale markets. North Korea is really not socialist. It doesn't have very good public distribution anymore. So I'm not sure. I don't think that's accurate. I use the term gangster because North Korea has a long record of engaging in illicit gray market and black market activities. These are pretty well established now. People smuggling, trafficking, gold smuggling, drug smuggling. The North Koreans used to smuggle enormous amounts of methamphetamines. Apparently, the North Koreans were made the best meth in Asia or something like that. That's what they used to say. Insurance fraud. The North Koreans don't export anything. There's nothing that people want from them. And so to gain external hard currency, they engaged in criminality beginning in the 1970s. And then I call it a fiefdom because it's a monarchy. It's a clan-based dictatorship, right? It's the Kims and all of their friends and associates and buddies and people they've married to and people whose grandfathers fought against the Japanese back during the war and stuff like that. Sort of like China, we have the princelings, mm-hmm. all the people sort of descended from the people who fought with Mao. North Korea is sort of the same way, and they're all kind of bound together by their shared history of relations with Kim Il-sung, the founder of the state, and the blood they all have on their hands, of course, and their gangster behavior. I mean, they're all sort of, it's sort of what is it? Who said that Thomas Jefferson or Benjamin Franklin, right? We all hang together or we all hang separately, and that's sort of where the Kims are. Right, you got about 200,000 people that run North Korea, right? And they have to stay together because if they actually turn on one another and the regime falls apart, they'll all wind up in front of South Korean hangmen. South Korea still has a death penalty, and so you've got this kind of thick clan at the top, and that's what pastes together North Korea's various institutions, the party, the military. Right, they're all sort of sewn together by these blood and family links at the top.
What about the race question? Because I know this has been written about for several years by observers like B.R. Myers.
Yeah, Brian Myers, yeah.
And I was interested to see in the brief public remarks that Kim Jong-un made at the summit last week that he appealed to the common blood of the Korean right. people, which on one level might be seen as fairly inoffensive, a reference to a common humanity or to common heritage. But am I right in reading a slightly sinister racial subtext into that?
Yeah, this is a big debate. So socialism is gone, Marxism, Leninism, communism, this is out. North Korea's ideology is arguably just nationalism. The Koreans have sort of a perception of themselves as a long, distinct, individualized blood community that goes back several thousand years. The most maximal sort of Korean historians will tell you goes back 5,000 years. Which would make the Korean race older than the pyramids, so it's probably not true. But this belief is really deeply rooted. In South Korea, it creates a lot of problems with integration of foreigners and multiculturalism and stuff and things like that. And in North Korea, it's even worse, right? And so that's where you, that's where Meyer's argument came from, right? Is that the North Korean state has always argued a kind of nationalism to reunify the two Koreas, and it has used a race theme to undergird that. So there is this kind of discussion about what would that mean? Does that mean like, so like if North Korea were like absorb South Korea, does that mean you get like kind of like a racial genocide of like mixed race Koreans and South Korea and stuff like that? There has been intimations that the North Koreans might do things like that, but not very much. It's still kind of a controversial thesis. I'm comfortable saying that nationalism is North Korea's ideology. Not quite comfortable saying it's kind of like a Nazistic or kind of fascistic level of race. I don't think that's fully accepted yet in the community.
Okay, so my last question before I open it up to all of yours, and there will be microphones going around for you. A question about South Korea, where you've lived now for, I think, 10 years. Tell us something about South Korea that you think might surprise us as outsiders, something about South Korean politics that, you know, in the context of this long
sure.
dispute with North Korea,
sure.
that would perhaps surprise us.
South Korea is really polarized about North Korea. You have, on the right, you have a virulently anti-communist to the point of McCarthyite paranoia. And on the left, you have a surprisingly generous-minded attitude towards North Korea. I'm surprised how few sort of centrists you actually have where you sort of understand that North Korea is not like, you know, you guys saw Dr. Strangelove, right? The North Koreans aren't, you know, poisoning the water or something like that. You get that kind of conspiracy stuff on the right in South Korea. But also, so there's that. I'm kind of surprised you don't have more conservatives who don't think that North Korea is like undercutting South Korean institutions, but on the other hand, are prepared to sort of acknowledge North Korea for what it is. There's a lot of ideological lenses play a big role in South Korea and understanding North Korea, which I think is a shame. And so, like on the left, you know, I get students, I see this all the time, you know, that, like in the United States, or like in a lot of countries, you know, the youth tend to be more liberal in South Korea, they are, and they're more dovish on North Korea. And my students, they always say to me, like, oh, you know, it doesn't make any difference if the North Koreans have nuclear weapons because they would never nuke us because we're a part of that same community. We're part of the same Korean community. The Minjok is the Korean term, it's the racial community. And I'm always like, wow, really? Really? So you don't need, and it's like, well, we don't need missile defense because the North Koreans would never use nuclear weapons against us. Wow. So like moderate hawks like me are kind of shocked. But then I go to Seoul and I meet like my conservative friends and they're like, you know, that's what they have. They now have the hotline between Pyongyang and Seoul because the Moon government, they're liberals, they want to call up Kim Jong-un every day and, you know, find out what their orders are. Like, I mean, conservatives in South Korea believe this too. And so that it's kind of crazy, right? You have this real sort of sharp polarization. So if you look at like the day after the Panmunjom Declaration, there were the righties were out in the streets, like in Seoul, like waving pictures of Donald Trump and American flags and Israeli flags, and you know, Moon Jae-in is a traitor and he's a communist. I mean, it really is, opinion in South Korea is really, really sharply polarized, actually, much more so than I would have expected given how threatening North Korea is.
From here you'd expect North Korea to be the overwhelmingly dominant political
right.
issue in South Korean
right.
politics. Is that the case?
And it's not. It's not. It is for conservatives, it is for about, I think, maybe 25% of the country, the elderly. But for a lot of South Koreans, especially on the left, it's just not. It's one other issue, in part because North Korea isn't seen as so threatening. And if only we could, you know, if only the South Korean left could move out, you know, the conservatives and the Americans, they could have direct relationship with North Korea one-to-one, we could find some kind of, you know, modus vivendi. And other issues are, you know, social welfare issues are you know, fill up the newspapers as well. Issues like pollution and free school lunches for kids and the birth rate and stuff like that. I mean, North Korea does not dominate South Korean politics the way you would think. And that's also one of the things that really surprised me when I moved to South Korea. Because it strikes me that it should be, because North Korea, to my mind, is an existential threat to South Korea's way of life. But a lot of South Koreans don't share that, and that's always been a surprise to me.
Let's begin with your question. So,
good evening. My name is Jackie Westerman. I'm from the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, where I'm a researcher in the international program. My
Hi.
Question would be in regards to other players than the US around the peninsula. So let's say we go with a 20% chance that the summit goes very badly, in my opinion, that would probably question the credibility of American diplomacy skills, probably replaced by other players. Could be the Chinese, but could also be the Russians, which are often very overlooked in the region. So how would you assess that?
I think that the Chinese would be the other player. I tend to discount the, and maybe you and I should talk about this after, but I tend to discount the Russian role in Northeast Asia. You may disagree. We can sort of argue about that if you want. But I think that Russian power in East Asia has really been badly eclipsed, actually. I think Putin mostly uses North Korea as a spoiler against the United States for other issues that he cares more about, particularly in the Middle East and in Eastern Europe. I would argue that I think the Chinese are really the key. I've argued repeatedly for years for you and elsewhere that the route to Pyongyang runs through Beijing. The sanctions enforcement mostly relies on Chinese compliance or non-compliance. Something like 90%, 92% of North Korea's trade goes through China, and more importantly, North Korea's finance goes through Chinese banks. And you know, this has been a regular issue between the U.S. Treasury and the People's Bank of China, right? We're trying hard to get the Chinese to crack down on North Korean money, and a lot of that is illegal money. So China is the big player. Japan and Russia are kind of, I would argue, they're sort of bit players. The big role for the Japanese is that if there's ever a final deal with North Korea, if we ever get some kind of North Korean normalization, the Japanese are going to be expected to fork over a huge pile of aid. And I think the Japanese kind of get unfairly shuffled to the side during the political part of it, with this sort of expectation they just fork over a lot of money to Korea. Because Japan was a colonial power in Korea for 35 years. I think that, yeah, if the Americans, if Trump writes the Americans out of this because he flips up the table and walks out like he threatened to do, then it goes to China.
G'day, Ben Coleman from Strategic and Defense Studies Center at ANU. You talked earlier about how we sort of can tend to overinvest external pressure influences on North Korea. So what does North Korea want out of the deal, and can those who have to give up something in that deal actually meet their expectations, in particular Washington?
Yeah, that's a good question. I do not believe that the North Koreans actually want unification. I do not believe that the North Koreans could actually absorb South Korea in a way that could retain the very unique particularities of the North Korean system. I think trying to absorb South Korea would overwhelm the extremely rigid, extremely singular, extremely boutique kind of elements of the North Korean system. North Korea has an internal class system, the Songbun system, which is really, really complicated and just would not be able to absorb 50 million newcomers accustomed to democracy and freedom, things like that. So I don't actually think the North Koreans actually want to absorb South Korea. That sets me apart from sort of more conservative and hawkish commentators who think the North Koreans still have the old goals. I think what the North Koreans really want more than anything else is just permanent subsidization from the South, right? The North Koreans have been proposing since the 70s a confederation of the two Koreas, right? Sort of like a thin covering confederation on the top. You'd basically sort of the two sort of siloed states under one kind of covering set of institutions. Right, and they would be very thin, so you really wouldn't actually have like joint governance. But South Korea would basically be expected to start paying for stuff, right? I mean, South Korea routinely, whenever you get sort of North Korean South Korean interactions, South Koreans always pay for everything. Right? I mean, this is all one of the things I always know, and I always put this in my Twitter feed. Like when the North Korean Olympics come to like the Asian Games or the Olympics or something like that, South Koreans are always footing the bill, right? I mean, it's always a racket, right? It's always a gangster state. They're always looking for a handout. They're always looking for money, right? And so
their embassies too, right?
Yeah, and so the embassies and you guys know this, the overseas embassies engage in all kinds of gangsterism to pay for their bills because they're basically forced to like be self-supporting, which means they engage in criminality. So I don't actually think it's some kind of like unified DPRK. That would be a bridge too far for North Korea now. North Korea is just too far behind. You'd have 50 million South Koreans screaming and revolting. It would be like American Reconstruction when the American North tried to occupy the American South, and it was just too difficult because you had massive civil resistance, and the American North just gave up and went home, and you basically had the reimposition of white hierarchy for another 90 years. It would be the same thing. The KPA, the Korean People's Army, the North Korean military, tried to occupy South Korea. It would be overwhelmed by that, and it would fracture it, and the reverberations would fracture North Korea. So I don't think they want that. I think they just want the cash, so that North Korea can continue to exist basically indefinitely, right? We know that North Korea cannot exist without external inputs. North Korea, despite its ideology, is not autarkic and never has been. It was dependent on inputs throughout the Cold War. And if we can get those inputs for free and permanently from South Korea, cash, right, oil and cash particularly, then they're not so much dependent. Then they're not so dependent on China, right? It's better to be dependent on South Korea than it is on China. So that's that. To my mind, that's the long-term goal. The goal of nuclearization is to prevent American-led regime change. I think there's a pretty broad agreement now that the North Koreans have told us this, right? The North Koreans have said that, you know, Gaddafi and Saddam Hussein would still be alive if they had nuclear weapons. I think we all agree with that. So then the question is sort of what would they offer? You know, this is something that Sam and I have talked about. You know, maybe they'll. It looks like they're going to offer some kind. If I had to guess, it looks like they're going to offer some kind of deal where they might put caps on ICBMs or roll back the ICBM program to get a deal with the Americans.
You should just say what that is, ICBM.
Intercontinental ballistic missiles, excuse me. So this is something that Sam has actually floated in the last couple of days and increasingly strikes me as accurate. Right? The North Koreans can strike the United States with an intercontinental ballistic missile. Right? Well, if they were to give that up in exchange for an American agreement to a peace treaty or the removal of American forces or something like that, that takes away the great existential threat to the Americans from North Korea. And they would still face South Korea, and it would still, you know, they're still at a disadvantage to South Korea. But if they can get a deal out of Trump that significantly reduces the American threat in exchange maybe for some kind of caps or limits or getting back in the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, or getting cameras into the North Korean facilities or something like that, that would be my sense of what the deal might be. I think the president might go for it. The big problem will be implementation, though, verification, right? This is what killed the six-party talks and the agreed framework before then, right? I mean, ultimately, the North Koreans have got to let inspectors in there, and that means cameras. And the North Koreans have not been happy with that in the past. So I'm actually, again, I'm pretty skeptical it's going to happen because the North Koreans would actually have to give up a lot. But two things. First, the removal of U.S. forces in Korea, actually getting the 28,500 warfighters and USFK out. And second, the abrogation of the alliance. The United States could continue to provide a lot of alliance support and protection to South Korea, even if American ground forces were removed from South Korea. So the removal of USFK is actually militarily not actually that big a deal. It has a lot of other sort of cultural and economic importance, I think. But militarily, I would argue it's actually not that important. The real issue is the alliance, right? So if we left, the United States could still provide maritime and air support from Japan, right? We have a lot of stuff in Japan. We have a lot of stuff in Guam, a lot of stuff at Kadena and Okinawa, and all that could be projected. And you could also keep the flow-through structure, the support structure in South Korea, so American forces could flow back in if there were a conflict, right? If the North Koreans were to demand the removal of all of that, then we would presumably ask for a great deal more. I mean, if the South Koreans are going to give up the alliance, then they should demand that the North Koreans go to zero for nukes, not just zero ICBMs, but everything. But I don't think the North Koreans will do that.
Hi, my name is PJ. As I was watching the recent summit, it kind of obviously made me think of the summit that happened in 2000 when Kim Dae-jung was in charge. And that was a big deal at the time, obviously. And soon after that, there came the revelation that North Korea got paid a big cash check kind of behind the scenes, and that kind of, you know, took right. The wind out of everyone who believed that, you know, that was all kind of thanks to the Sunshine Policy, which is the approach at the time, and which to this day I want to believe actually kind of, you know, was very meaningful and had a lot of potential. And I was thinking about that because obviously it is a very drastic change in the attitude that we saw from Kim Jong-un, one that made me wonder, you know, what is the actual motivation behind that? And you just kind of touched on North Korea having the tendency to want a bit of a payout, you know, most of the time. So I guess my question is two-part. First is, what do you think are the possibilities of there having been some kind of like a background, like a behind-the-scenes deal like that, that was, you know, in place in 2000? And the second part of the question, I guess, is, you know, President Moon's approach to North Korea reminds me a lot of the Sunshine Policy from back then. And what do you think, how effective do you think that was, and how much potential do you think that'll have going forward?
Okay, so for the 2000 summit, it is now established that Kim Jong-il, the North Korean leader at the time, received a direct personal cash handout of $500,000 to go. This is what I mean when we say the gangster state. I mean, like, literally the summit was delayed for 24 hours because he didn't get the suitcase with the dollar bills in it. It's like something out of The Simpsons, right? With like the dollar sign on the suitcase. Like, literally, I mean, really, it really is a gangster state. So that's established now. I think the Sunshine Policy was worth a try in 1997-98 because we didn't actually know how North Korea would respond. But I think by 2007, to my mind, I think it was pretty clear that South Korea was getting suckered by the Sunshine Policy, which is to say that the South Koreans were making a series of concessions and the North Koreans really weren't making meaningful counter-concessions. A nice example of this is a shared industrial park that the two Koreas built around the North Korean city of Kaesong. It was called the Kaesong Industrial Zone. So the idea of the Kaesong Industrial Zone was that South Korean firms would go in there and open up factories. North Korean workers would come in and they would sort of like see South Korean managerial techniques. They would see South Korean entrepreneurialism and they would go back and start up their own little little firms. They would start their own little restaurants handiwork craft shops and stuff like that, right? You see sort of like small scale capitalism like bubbling up from below, right? And instead what the North Koreans did is basically treat it as an enclave economy. They basically put up a wall around the entire thing, right to the border, and basically sealed it all off from the rest of the country. So there was no synergy, there was no spillover effect at all, right? They basically treated it as a semi-permanent subsidy. The people who worked there didn't actually get paid directly in US dollars. The companies paid the North Korean government, which then paid the workers in local North Korean currency, the Korean people's won, which is basically worthless, right? And so by 2015, it had basically become a subsidy to the North Korean dictatorship. Basically, you're paying a dictatorship. You're giving them free money every year. And they were using this, one, not just for their own purposes, for the luxury goods and everything else, but more importantly, what a lot of people don't know is they're also using that to launder a lot of their illicit gains, right? If you give them $50 million a year legally, that allows them to wash who knows how much illegally, right? Because they're bringing in all this other money from the meth and the insurance fraud and everything else, right? So I thought that stopping Kaesong was a good idea because it helped crimp up the black market stuff. But I mean, that's the problem, right? I do this with my students a lot, with my Korean students. I'm like, name one big obvious thing that South Korea got from the Sunshine Policy. It's hard to actually identify like one big concession the North Koreans gave us. So I think it was a good idea to try, but I also think it was a good idea to end it.
Thank you. Margaret Toomey from the Office of National Assessments. When we look at from the outside at North Korea, we see Kim, Kim Jong-un, we used to see his father, we used to see his grandfather, a bit of a cult of personality thing going on there. It looks like, I think we can be fairly sure now that Kim is in charge and calling the shots. But I'd be very interested in any thoughts you could offer on how much of the strategizing you think Kim's doing himself, or who or is he taking advice from? And what insights do you think the saturation media coverage of last Friday tell us? Can we learn anything more about Kim from that?
Yeah, your first question is a tough one. North Korea has institutions, but they're pretty flimsy, we assume. We don't really know, right? North Korea has a cabinet and has a Politburo. Just like old Soviet, classical Soviet systems, the North Koreans have sort of like a super cabinet mixed with a Politburo together. It's called the State Affairs Commission. As the chairman of the State Affairs Commission that Kim Jong-un rules, so our working assumption is that those are the people from whom he takes advice and whatever. It's also almost certainly the case that he takes advice from his sister and his wife, right? I mean, North Korea has sort of a long history of sort of like family-based rule at the very top. Beyond that, it's really hard to know, right? In fact, I mean, one of the things that, you know, Kim Jong-un's actually been pretty good at is actually getting rid of people who are connected to his dad, right? I mean, he actually has been sort of culling the KPA brass now for a while, right? He's killed several hundred of them. So it's actually not the case, and we think it's really not the case anymore that he's actually leaning on retainers and courtiers from the past, that he's actually increasingly becoming independent of them and really is running it now as a direct personalist autocracy. It's hard to, beyond that, it's hard to sort of speculate on who he's talking to. I would argue that the primary institutions in North Korea, besides the family at the top, are the party and the military. So presumably the top folks there, I mean, they're on the State Affairs Commission anyway, but presumably those are the ones he's most listening to, right? Those are the ones he needs the most to maintain first authority and second ideological indoctrination. But beyond that, I'm not too sure.
There was a second part of that question, which I was interested to hear your thoughts on, about the effect that the media attention had.
Yeah. What is that? What effect is that having, sort of like on North Koreans?
Yes. Right.
Oh. Yeah. I mean, it was the South Korean media was like gushing. Oh, he's so jovial, and he's like so happy and smiling, and he looks so happy, and he's laughing, and they're hugging. You know, Moon Jae-in didn't have to hug him. He didn't have to hug him, right? We didn't have to. He could have just shook his hand. We didn't have to have the hugging. I don't know why we had to have the hugging. Okay. No, really, we have to hug the gangster, right? Can we just shake his hand? Okay. But no, I mean, there's a lot of this, right? And then there was also you guys may have seen the shot where they were sitting outside, the two of them alone, on some like porch deck or something like that, right? And from what the South Korean media was saying, Moon Jae-in President Moon was talking to him in a kind of like father figurely sort of tone. We don't know, but that's how it's being reported, that Kim Jong-un came to him because he's half his age, right? And this is Korea, right? Sort of Confucianism, gerontocracy, and all that, right? I mean, age is important in Korea. And so apparently that filtered through, that sort of like that received sort of Korean traditional behavior sort of actually filtered into this discussion. My own sense is that it's actually not that meaningful. Whether Kim Jong-un used proper forms of address, for example, I don't know if that really means anything. I tend to discount that sort of stuff, actually. I think the structural interests in North Korea in favor of keeping nuclear weapons, for example, to my mind, are a lot more important than the individual relationships at the top. The only exception I would make to that rule would be that just the enormous wildcard behavior of Donald Trump. But other than that, I tend to discount the personalities. But
just a quick follow-up to that. One thing that I found surprising in some of the things that Kim Jong-un was quoted as saying during the summit was that he seemed to admit, in some asides, the slightly decrepit nature of the North Korean state, of its infrastructure, and so on. I thought it was kind of a staple of North Korean life that the country, the nation
right.
itself, was
utopia. Yeah.
What was superior in every material way.
Yeah, this has become a lot harder to maintain. The sort of the Potemkin village facade of North Korea has become much harder to maintain in the last 20 years. When the famine struck in the late 1990s, North Koreans were so desperate to eat that they fled across the rivers to connect with ethnic Koreans in northeastern China. And that's how they brought back food to help sort of mitigate the worst parts of the famine. And they built a lot of linkages with those Koreans. Those linkages have persisted and have acted as sort of like a highway for all kinds of information to come into North Korea. Flash keys with South Korean movies and television commercials and soap operas and stuff like that. So the information cordon around North Korea has long since been pierced, right? So I'm actually not surprised that that is such a big deal anymore, because it's now established that I think it's reasonably well known in North Korea that South Korea is wealthier. The North Korean argument is that, that the Yankee colony and stuff like that, right? That's what North Korea calls South Korea, the Yankee colony. My students love that part, right? But that's the argument, right? That, North Korea may be poorer, but it is purer, and it is unsullied by American and Japanese corporate interests and military interests. That's what the North Koreans tell you, by the way, when you go to North Korea. Like, we're the real Korea because we're not manipulated by the Japanese and the Americans.
Joanna Hewitt from the Lowy Board, Robert. I'd be interested in any thoughts you might have on how developments in the Iran agreement, American policy towards that agreement, might play into the situation. There are a couple of different positions on this, but is it a focus of North Korean attention, and how might it influence developments?
I'm actually kind of surprised how little that gets in the South Korean press. My own sense is that if the Trump people throw that out, then that's going to be a big warning sign to the North Koreans. Don't sign a deal with the Americans. I mean, we sort of work in the assumption that the North Koreans in these negotiations are the ones with a credibility problem, because the North Koreans cheat on deals all the time, and that's true. They did. They cheated on the last one, the Leap Day deal in 2012. But, the Americans cheated on the deal with Gaddafi. I mean, Gaddafi's dead because we basically stabbed him in the back and supported the Arab Spring revolutionaries. And we told them we weren't going to do that, and we did it. I mean, if you're, and if we do that with the Iranians, again, And the North Koreans are never going to give up their stuff. I mean, this is why the analyst community, I mean, I don't think like a lot of people who work on North Korea, like a lot, think that the North Koreans are going to give up their nuclear weapons. They won't give them up, all of them, right? So it gets the question to the U.S., right? Maybe they'll give up the ICBMs like you're saying or something like that. But I'd be amazed if they go to zero. Because the whole point of building these things was to keep the Americans at bay, right? Once you give it all up, then you're subject to what happened to Gaddafi. The Americans stab you in the back. And if we, the Americans, throw out the Iran deal, even though the Iranians are, you know, meeting the benchmarks, I can't imagine the North Koreans wouldn't see that as yet another reason not to deal. This is why the summit's going to be a bust. I mean, the summit is almost certainly not going to be a breakthrough. It's going too fast. They don't have enough staff, and the issues are just too wide. These massive issues are not going to be resolved in 9 weeks. So I'm really, really skeptical that Trump is going to be able to bring home anything really substantial. It's probably going to be a bunch of small beer stuff, and then it'll get kicked to the lawyers and the bureaucrats and the diplomats, and then it'll be like years of hashing out and arguing, which will look an awful lot like it did 10 years ago during the six-party talks. That's my prediction for like the next year or so. I would be amazed if Trump can bring home some big thing, and it's only going to get worse if you're correct. If the Iran deal goes south, then the North Koreans will probably play even harder.
Dr. Malcolm Davis Aspie. When I was watching the imagery of Kim Jong-un walking across the main demarcation line and walking up to the Peace Palace or the Peace House, he seemed to be gasping for breath and struggling to breathe and looked pretty unhealthy. So yeah. Black swan scenario, what happens if Kim Jong-un dies or is incapable of remaining in office? Is there a power struggle that could then derail this entire process or make it worse right. Or potentially make it better?
Yeah. The South Korean version of the CIA is called the National Intelligence Service, NIS. NIS actually keeps track of his weight and his health in general. There is actually sort of like a little cottage industry of work on like how much he weighs and what he eats and how much he smokes and stuff like that. Apparently, he's a very heavy smoker. Apparently, he smokes like 3 or 4 packs a day or something like that. And he's also very heavy, so you can only imagine. His father, of course, was an alcoholic. Kim Jong-il had a pancreatic stroke in 2008 and was incapacitated for 6 months. There was a lot of anxiety in the later years when Kim Jong the extent of Kim Jong Il's drinking became revealed. I mean, apparently he was drinking a bottle of Hennessy a day. And there was anxiety that he would wake up one day, you know, sort of blotto, and you know he might like push a button and start a war because he was bombed. No, really, there really was. There was actually genuine concern. You know, this gets. I mean, these guys, they're like Nero, right? You know, they have like these, you know, the big appetites, right? And they're running around and. Okay. However, so this was sort of, so the idea, so there was this argument, right, that like, okay, so like North Korea is like this autocratic system, right? It's like a Sun King monarchy. And what happens if the Sun King just keels over one day? Well, that actually happened in 2011. That's how Kim Jong-il died. And a lot of people, including me, thought, okay, wow, this is it. I mean, this is the regime crisis we're all waiting for, right? The successor isn't groomed. He's this young 27-year-old kid. We've only known about him for a couple years. He's off in Switzerland partying with Dennis Rodman. There's no way the KPA is going to take him seriously, right? I mean, that's what a lot of people thought, that the KPA, the Korean People's Army, the brass was going to see him as just some kid. They're going to keep him as a figurehead or kill him. And actually, he survived. Not only did he survive, he got rid of all of his opponents, right? He's called the brass the party, right? He's brought the party back to life as a counterweight to the military. Right? And North Korea hasn't actually changed. North Korea hasn't actually liberalized, despite Dennis Rodman and going to school in Switzerland and all this other stuff. He hasn't been a glasnost figure at all. I have to admit, that surprised me a lot. And that's one of the biggest incorrect calls I've made in my history researching North Korea. I genuinely thought, I can only say I feel bad because a lot of other people thought this too, including Victor Cha, so I feel a little bit better. But he's a much bigger name than me, Victor Cha. But a lot of people thought that, you know, if he just one day, if the Sun King just dies, you know, there's a hole at the center and the thing should implode. And that didn't happen, which tells me that North Korea has some other sources of institutional strength that we don't know about. And we just don't know. I mean, the back rooms of Pyongyang, presumably there's a lot of knife fighting, but we just don't know. So I'm much more skeptical now than it would have been 8 years ago that if, you know, he falls over from a heart attack, that you're actually going to see an implosion. That's very unfortunate. At the very minimum, I would have expected some kind of factional infighting, but that didn't happen either. I mean, the system kind of didn't miss a beat, which is fairly amazing, actually. You'd think it would have, but it didn't.
Thanks. My name is Sarah from a political researcher at the Korean Embassy. And I just have a question. As we know, Kim Jong-un promised complete denuclearization at the Panmunjom Declaration. But then this did not mean North Korea's denuclearization, but denuclearization of the entire Korean Peninsula. So what do you think this would involve? Do you think it'll involve strategic denuclearization or tactical weapons removal, or what do you think?
Yeah, so there's this big debate. There's a little cottage industry that's popped up in the last 2 or 3 weeks on Twitter and whatnot. Like, what does denuclearization mean in the Korean context? First of all, the United States doesn't have nuclear weapons in South Korea anymore, right? This is pretty well established. Unless the Americans are sort of sneaking them in or something like that, we don't have that anymore. The United States will always retain the ability to strike North Korea with nuclear weapons. So if the North Koreans insist that denuclearization mean that the United States can't strike them with nuclear weapons, no deal will ever happen because the United States is not going to, like, destroy 5,000 nuclear warheads to get a deal with the North Koreans, right? That's just not going to happen. I don't know if the United States stations short-range nuclear weapons anywhere in Asia. I don't believe we do, which means, we're clean. We, the Americans, we're kind of at zero regionally, as far as I know. If anyone knows better than me, please tell me. But as far as I know, we the Americans, we're at zero regionally. If denuclearization meant the Americans couldn't strike North Korea with nuclear weapons, then that would mean getting rid of American weapons in the homeland, right? Like the Minuteman III, we're never going to do that. So then if the United States retains the ability to massively retaliate against North Korea, which we almost certainly will, presumably the North Koreans will want to keep some ability also. So denuclearization does not mean North Korea going to zero. It means some kind of mix of caps, a missile count, a stockpile inventory, maybe rolling back ICBMs, maybe a limit at like 40 warheads or some kind of test limit. Right now we think the North Koreans can detonate a weapon of around half a megaton, 500 kilotons. So maybe they would like limit their warhead size to that. Maybe the throw weight limits. That's sort of like how big of a weapon you can throw in the air. This is why we have the nuke guys, right? I mean, they're real experts on this and they sort of hammer these details out. I would be amazed if the North Koreans went to zero. I mean, the concessions they would ask for to go to zero would be enormous, right? They would almost certainly ask for the end of the American alliance, the removal of American forces from Korea, possibly the removal of some American forces from Japan, right? And then a huge economic aid package. I mean, if the North Koreans could very well say to Trump something like this: okay, we'll do denuclearization, but it's going to take 15 years, and we need $50 billion to do it. And then it gets strung out, and we're talking about this, for months and months and months, right? I mean, John Bolton has said that he wants to do denuclearization the way we did with Gaddafi, where like an American cargo jet or two flies in, right? They roll the stuff up and they fly out, and that's the end of the North Korean nuclear deal. It gets shipped off to Nevada or something like that. There's just no way the North Koreans are going to do that, right? I mean, nobody thinks they're going to do that, right? Instead, it's going to be a long, protracted debate in which the Americans have to make all kinds of minor concessions along the way to get North Korean minor concessions too. And I think it's kind of a shame with the summit last week, is that we had an opportunity to actually kind of get that ball rolling, to kind of get some South Korean input on this too, because presumably the South Koreans have like their own opinion about what denuclearization in North Korea should be. And I think they kind of missed a chance, right? This kind of got kicked to the Trump administration, which is almost certainly going to be less prepared for this than the Moon administration. The Moon administration is taking this much more seriously than the Trump administration. And it's kind of surprising that they pushed this onto Trump, given his erratic wild card kind of character.
Ladies and gentlemen, would you join me in thanking Robert Kelly?
Thank you very much.